Welcome, members and guests, to the January 23rd program of the City Club of Eugene, The Public Trust Doctrine, Will Courts Protect Resources? Thank you for joining us. Greetings to our broadcast television and radio audience. I'm Marlene Nessery, City Club President. Our sponsors today are John Brown from Evans, Elder & Brown, Eugene Legal, Small Firm, Big Results, and KRVM. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space, and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and for archiving the podcasts on their site. Thanks as well to the Sheet Metal Workers Local No. 16 Training Institute for hosting a recent session of our career course, which is a project of City Club, Lane Workforce Partnership, and Lane Educational Service District. A quick reminder that we host nearly 50 original nonpartisan issue programs every year. If you believe with us that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please do join us. We welcome donors, sponsors, members, volunteers, and students, anyone who has a stake in community life. We also welcome your contributions to our new special events fund. Planning has begun for our exciting launch event this spring, a program with the first female justice of the United States Supreme Court, the Honorable Sandra Day O'Connor. Look for more details in coming weeks. Today's program, The Public Trust Doctrine, Will Courts Protect Resources, is coordinated by John DeWinter. He'll introduce our speaker and first questioner.
Thank you, Marlene. As Marlene said, today's program is titled The Public Trust Doctrine, Will Courts Protect Natural Resources? Our speaker is Mary Christina Wood. The public trust doctrine is a theory or a tool which ordinary citizens like you and me can use to seek a court order directing our governments, local, state, and federal, to take action to protect our environment when those governments have otherwise failed to do so. Although the public trust doctrine has been part of our law for centuries, it only recently has become the underpinning of citizen lawsuits seeking to protect our air. Lawsuits that, as a group, are called atmospheric trust litigation. Our speaker today, Mary Christina Woods, has been and is a leading advocate for extending the reach or the application of the public trust doctrine to our atmosphere. Mary is a professor of law and the faculty director, as well as the founding director of the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Program at the University of Oregon. She earned her Bachelor of Arts degree in political science at the University of Washington, where she graduated summa cum laude. Her Doctor of Jurisprudence degree is from the Stanford Law School. She is the author of Nature's Trust, Environmental Law for a New Ecological Age, a book published in 2013 by the Cambridge University Press. Mary grew up along the Columbia River in the Portland-Vancouver area. She is married and has three sons who attend schools in Eugene. She comes by her interest in conservation honestly, as she is the great-granddaughter of both C.E.S. Wood and Henry J. Biddle, who were early Northwest conservationists. Please welcome Mary Christina Wood.
Well, thank you, John, and it's my honor to be here with all of you. History holds transformative moments when injustice suddenly emerges into justice, when oppression suddenly flips into rights, when people relegated to the back of the bus can one day exercise their right to sit anywhere on the bus, when tribal members arrested for fishing can exercise their treaty right to a fair share of the harvest, and when couples denied the blessings of marriage can exercise their rights to marry. Judicial opinions may catalyze these momentous turns, but they never appear out of nowhere. The greatest judges of our time have simply voiced their own conscience and the righteous sense of the people. It's not that the law before them had changed, but rather that the principled sense of the community had evolved, and oppression could no longer be tolerated. These judges decided to rule on the right side of history. Today, across this nation and this world, citizens demand an end to corporate environmental oppression. As the science of climate change, species extinctions, dying oceans moves from the vaguely alarming to the truly mortifying, citizens voice a right held by our children to inherit the natural wealth that sustains us now. Now, this right has been taking shape in our national consciousness for a very long time. President Theodore Roosevelt expressed it a century ago when he stood at the rim of the Grand Canyon and declared, "We have gotten past this stage, my fellow citizens, when we are to be pardoned if we treat any part of our country as something to be skinned for 2 or 3 years for the use of the present generation, whether it is forest, the water, or the scenery. Whatever it is, handle it so that your children's children will get the benefit of it." President Roosevelt voiced a public trust obligation. If we look back in time, across all cultures, we find an ancient moral covenant that runs from one generation to the next to protect the natural bounty so that we'll pass down the lineage of humanity. This moral covenant manifests in the law as the public trust doctrine. This principle has been part of our law since the earliest days of our nation, but it has been ignored in the last few decades, ironically, because the explosive growth of environmental statutory law. Now, nearly everyone today looks at statutes like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act as the total measure of environmental responsibility, but government agencies have used those statutes to actually legalize colossal damage that endangers our communities. So today we will ask how the public trust principle can turn this legalized destruction into a project of massive environmental restoration before it is too late. Let us begin by describing the public trust. Government is the enduring institution of society. So courts have said that it holds natural wealth in trust for the citizens. This is a constitutional duty that can never be abrogated. So you might imagine all of the resources essential to our human welfare, like the waters, the wildlife, and the air, as being bound together in one legal package. Well, the beneficiaries of this great trust are all present and future generations of citizens. The purpose of the trust is to secure the ecology necessary to support the citizens through the ages. So trustees are strictly obligated to protect this natural wealth. Now, why on earth would we need such a principle in the law? Because without it, our political leaders may use their immense power over natural resources to serve their political interests at posterity's expense. The landmark decision announcing this public trust was an 1872 case called Illinois Central Railroad, and there, the U.S. Supreme Court confronted a situation it had never seen before. The state legislature had conveyed the entire Chicago shoreline of Lake Michigan to a private railroad company. Can you imagine? This was land that the citizens needed for fishing and navigation and commerce. And the court held that the legislature simply did not have the power to make this grant because the shoreline was held in trust for the public. In fact, it said such a grant would be, quote, a grievance which could never be long borne by a free people. The court said that citizens have public property rights in crucial ecology, and those rights could not be destroyed by any government. Well, this public trust principle springs from popular sovereignty. As Professor Joseph Sachs once put it, the public trust distinguishes a society of citizens from one of serfs. And when we understand that nature's trust supports our very survival, and no less so for our own children and future generations than for us, you can see that the public trust aims for the endurance rather than the expiration of this nation. Now, these rights held by the people should not be confused with any environmental statutes. These trust rights run much deeper, and they are properly understood as constitutional. They are assertable against the legislature itself, whereas statutes are not. Last year, the Chief Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court invoked the public trust to strike down a statute the state legislature had passed to promote fracking, which has fouled much of that state. Justice Castile wrote that the citizens hold, quote, inherent and indefeasible rights in ecology, rights that are so great and essential as to be ensconced as inviolate. While the case itself was confined to Pennsylvania, this basic pronouncement of rights applies in every state. Here in Oregon, we exercise those rights every time we walk along the beach. In 1969, our Oregon Supreme Court held that private property owners could not exclude the public from the beach. And without that court decision, you would not know a freedom that you may now actually take for granted. So let us ask, how might we, the people, evoke this same public trust to protect our climate system? Now, you might instead prefer to talk about fish or forests or rivers, for those are the parts of nature that you really love and want to protect. But please understand, when we talk about climate, we are talking about fish and forests and rivers. For without climate stability, we lose it all. All of the nature we treasure in this state. And without climate stability, we also lose personal security and individual liberty and private property and stable economies and democracy itself. For the climate system is the linchpin to all life on this planet and the platform for all of our personal freedoms. If we lose climate stability, we will enter a world that is likely unfathomable to most of us in this room. And yet, most of us have taken this climate system for granted. So let us begin by asserting our reality, because we really can't judge the law without knowing the context in which it is applied. We live during an astounding time in history, though you certainly would not know it from the rhetoric of most politicians or the habits of most citizens. We are the first generation that faces imminent peril to the very life-sustaining systems of our planet. Conservation biologists report that we have triggered the sixth major extinction in the planet's history. The oceans are more acidic than at any time in the last 300 million years due to the absorption of carbon dioxide that humans have emitted into the atmosphere from burning fossil fuels. And we are now fully into a climate emergency. 2014 is the hottest year in recorded history. Scientists now say the disintegration of the West Antarctic ice sheet is unstoppable, and the seas are rising much faster than scientists even predicted a decade ago. It is unnervingly common now to hear about threats to our own species and to civilization itself. The extreme climate impacts hitting our world right now have come from a mere 1.4 degree temperature rise Fahrenheit. Yet analysts say we are on track for an 11 degree temperature rise by the end of the century, and some even say much sooner than that. There is no one out there who gives any assurance that our children could survive that kind of heating. In fact, James Speth, former dean of the Yale School of Forestry, says, if we keep doing exactly what we are doing today, the world in the latter part of this century won't be fit to live in. Now, this sounds like some science fiction horror movie, but as Tony Blair said some years ago, Prime Minister of England a few years ago, he said, this disaster is not set to happen in some science fiction movie many years ahead, but in our lifetimes. Unless we act now, he said, the disastrous consequences will be irreversible. Now, we might all feel better if we had ample time to deal with this situation, and we used to have lots of time. The warning started decades ago, but our government trustees failed to act. So society kept burning more fossil fuels, and this situation now carries mind-blowing urgency as we sit on the brink of climate tipping points. For example, if the permafrost melts at the northern latitudes In accelerated fashion, the release of methane would send this planet into runaway heating. And there are several such dangerous feedbacks in nature's system. So when we consider the legal response, keep in mind that this is not some matter that we can address at our usual bureaucratic pace. Dr. James Hansen, formerly the nation's chief climate scientist at NASA, says, "We are on the hairy edge." Well, to have any chance of climate recovery, scientists say we must rapidly decarbonize society and leave well over 4/5 of the remaining fossil fuels in the ground. An international team led by Dr. Hansen calculated a glide path towards climate stability that calls for reducing carbon dioxide emissions 7% a year. Now, 7%, keep that number in your head, because this number gets bigger and our energy descent steeper every day we delay. Had we started action back in 2005, scientists estimate that a 3.5% annual reduction could have restored climate balance at 350 parts per million by the end of the century. In just one decade, that 3.5% has grown to 7%, and if we delay 5 years more, that 7% climbs exponentially to 15% a year. At some point, the cuts become so large that they can't be feasible. And that's when the window of opportunity would slam shut on us, essentially trapping our children inside a greenhouse of our own making. The problem here is not lack of solutions or alternatives. In fact, that's the good news. There are entire portfolios of measures available to decarbonize society without resort to nuclear power. But we do need government engagement at all levels. And this is, of course, why we have government, to take on massive collective problems. Government makes tax policy, it subsidizes industry, it manages infrastructure, it regulates pollution sources, and it can free us from corporate control over our energy choices. History shows us that this nation can respond urgently to a collective threat. 70 years ago, America mounted a heroic effort overnight in World War II, but our government was acting clearly on behalf of its citizens then. Today, we have officials acting to promote the very industry that profits from intensifying our peril. The fossil fuel industry has reserves of oil, gas, and coal several times the amount that would send our planet into climate disaster. Bill McKibben calls this industry public enemy number one and writes, "The numbers are simply staggering. This industry, and this industry alone, holds the power to change the physics and chemistry of our planet, and they're planning to use it." And President Obama, despite his strong climate rhetoric, is still ramping up fossil fuel production. Now, our region has been targeted as a major global gateway to push those fossil fuels out from the interior of America to the expanding markets of Asia. In just the last 3 years, we've seen 26 proposals for export facilities and pipelines up and down the coast of Oregon and Washington and British Columbia. The Sightline Institute concludes that those proposals would carry enough fuel to release 5 times the amount of carbon dioxide resulting from the fuel transported by Keystone Pipeline. And many of you have heard that Keystone emissions alone could amount to game over for the planet's climate system. So let's be clear. While Keystone is getting all the press right now, we in the Pacific Northwest are now on the front lines of the world's climate battle. So now we come back to the law. Of course, the very purpose of the law is to prevent harm. So you might reasonably assume that the law would force protection of our atmosphere. But conventional environmental law, that is the statutory law passed in the 1970s, has not done much at all to address this threat. And of course, the whole purpose of laws like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and many others was to force protection of our environment. But instead, let's look at what they have brought us. Toxic pollution, nuclear waste, clear-cutting, mountaintop removal, strip mining, wetlands destruction, fracking, deep-sea drilling, species extinction, dried-up rivers, drinking water pollution, ocean acidification, dead zones, climate crisis, and almost indescribable mutilation of this nation's landscapes. These statues did achieve some early successes, but the real onslaught has taken place since they were passed. It turns out that instead of protecting ecosystems, statutory law has legalized massive damage to them. The problem is this. Nearly all those statues have permit provisions that give vast discretion to the agencies to allow harm. These permit provisions were never supposed to swallow up the statutory purposes, but that is, in fact, what has happened. Nearly across the board, agencies have turned environmental law inside out. Their mindset is that permits are there to be granted. This is because industry groups have exerted relentless power on agencies for decades now. They purchase influence by making campaign contributions to the president and state governors that oversee this entire administrative structure. After years and years of this, many agencies fall captive to the very industries they regulate. Well, captured agencies look at industry as a client they must serve. The Environmental Protection Agency has been described as an agency under siege. The bottom line is that environmental laws that we have all relied on are now dangerously used to further the interests of polluting industries, and they cause massive harm that damages our families and our communities. And now, in the face of climate tipping points, we find ourselves shackled to multinationals whose pursuit of profit pushes us straight towards a future where there cannot be life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And our government leaders are sitting quietly on the sidelines or cheering them on. So why do we now focus on inalienable rights embedded in the public trust? Let me offer four reasons. First, we look to the public trust to hold our legislatures accountable. Simply put, the legislatures cannot rid themselves of the obligation to the public. The U.S. Supreme Court in Illinois Central said that the legislature, quote, may no more abdicate its trust over property in which the people are interested than it can abdicate its police powers. And the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed this seminal decision just 2 years ago. A constitutional restraint on legislatures becomes especially important when legislatures turn against the public, and that prospect is always there. Selling out our climate system to fossil fuel industries is the modern-day equivalent of the Illinois legislature granting Chicago's shoreline to a private railroad company. Quite simply, the citizen's survival cannot be a political question. That is why our courts have always recognized inalienable rights. Second, we need to revive a basic set of instructions for our government officials. Professor Gerald Torres describes the trust as the law's DNA because it imposes a set of organic duties that apply on any scale, from local to national. The most important of these is to protect the wealth in the trust. This is so obvious, you would not allow your trustee to bankrupt your trust. And courts say that trustees can't just sit idle and let trust assets be destroyed on their watch, which exactly describes our government as we run headlong into climate tipping points. Third, the public trust offers a macro response to match the crisis we face. The 1970s statutes were made for a very different age, and even if they were carried out, their micro focus doesn't offer a full solution. That is not to say that regulation under the Clean Air Act would not get us far, it certainly would, and government should proceed with it, but to become a zero-carbon society, we need to go beyond pollution regulation and spur initiatives in the transportation, energy, building, food, and waste sectors. So the task at hand is not to just embark on scattered measures, hoping they will all add up in time. Instead, a public trust response calibrates to nature's own carbon math. And fourth, the public trust brings a logical framework of property obligation to environmental problems that just jump borders. Statutes stop at the borders of the jurisdiction that makes them. That's why Idaho's law isn't applicable in Oregon. And so statutory law doesn't deal with resources that span more than one nation or state. The public trust is found in every state in this country and in many key nations throughout the world. A trust approach treats the resources as common property shared by all nations and states as co-trustees, each having the duty to protect the resource. In this way, the trust brings a more integral approach to problems that elude statutes. It offers a common sense premise of responsibility that citizens worldwide can use to hold their governments accountable accountable, even absent an international climate treaty, which may never come about. But in calling upon the trust principle, we have to recognize that rights are not meaningful unless they can ultimately be enforced by courts. Recall the main takeaway lesson of fifth grade civics class. Our Constitution rests on three, not two, branches of government. Courts remain crucial players in our democracy. The Founding Fathers designed this system just so that no one branch would grab too much power. Well, a trust without judicial enforcement is not a trust at all. It is a tyranny. But courts have become quite passive during the era of statutory environmental law. Their remedies for statutory violations are often very narrow and procedural, and they rarely change the course of ultimate destruction. Enforcing the public trust doctrine means operating in a different frame, one that deals with the rights of citizens. To vindicate these rights, courts have to require active vigilance and protection of trust property. Until now, courts have rarely been called upon to do that in the environmental context, but as we face imminent threats, we need those courts to step up and force legislatures and agencies to simply protect our survival resources. In the areas of civil rights, prison rights, treaty rights, and even education funding cases, courts have often forced delinquent officials to act. So this is nothing new to courts. Typically, they order the other branches to develop a plan to remedy the problem, and then they supervise to make sure that plan is carried out. And that way, the courts protect the citizens' fundamental rights without overstepping their constitutional boundaries. Courts can use the same model to enforce public trust rights. 4 years ago, youth across this nation turned to the courts to protect their constitutional right to inherit a stable climate system that is necessary to their survival. The Eugene nonprofit organization, Our Children's Trust, launched a global campaign of atmospheric trust litigation, bringing cases and petitions on behalf of youth in every state in this country and in other countries as well. These cases call upon the best available science to define government's fiduciary duty to protect the atmosphere. Now, remember, this duty just boils down to carbon math, the 7% glide path back to 350 parts per million that I explained earlier. The trust cases all demand that government trustees produce plans to carry out this necessary carbon dioxide reduction. Courts would not devise these plans. That is the trustee's job, after all. And different states would choose different measures. So this is not a matter of courts running the show. It's a matter of courts forcing the trustees to do their job. The Oregon atmospheric trust case was brought by two Eugene teenage girls and has drawn broad support in the form of amicus briefs filed by Mayor Kitty Piercy and local officials and local businesses, another filed by law professors from across the country, and yet another by some of the world's most renowned climate scientists. Other atmospheric trust cases and petitions are pending in other states, with more being filed in the coming months. And where cases have been dismissed on procedural grounds, lawyers representing those youth are reformulating those cases and bringing those trust rights back to court. Well, some state courts have denied the youth's claims, saying it's not their job to step into climate crisis. These judges believe that the duty to solve the problem rests with the other branches. And how right that is. But these branches have not acted beyond minimal steps. Last summer in this state, the Oregon Court of Appeals reversed the trial court's dismissal and said courts do have a duty to define the public trust rights of youth in the climate context. So Oregon now has the leading trust case positioned to define that right. And that case will be heard on March 13th in Lane County Circuit Court. Now, suffice it to say, judges have never before seen anything like the consequences for civilization that these cases exhibit. And there is no other case teed up beyond this trust litigation to force the action needed in the time remaining before those irreversible tipping points. As the scientists said in their amicus brief supporting these youth, and I'm going to quote here, failure to act with all deliberate speed functionally becomes a decision to eliminate the option of preserving a habitable climate system. From the leading scientists, the courts have the planet on their docket. So let us end by reflecting on the role of Oregonians as we bring our public trust rights to bear in this global crisis. We all know that relative to the world, the emissions of Oregon remain quite small. But we would sell our potential short if we just focused on the carbon reduction achieved here at home. For Oregon's influence spreads quite literally worldwide. As Margaret Mead once said, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. When I think of our state's role, I think of the great Oregon climate catapult. A catapult, or trebuchet, uses leverage ingeniously to launch an object a great distance. Let me describe three ways in which Oregonians are positioned to catapult carbon reduction across the world. First, citizens here understand the importance of this Oregon atmospheric trust case that will be heard March 13th. It is a key lawsuit in a global campaign that squarely asserts the legal duty of all governments to protect our climate. Citizens all over the country are desperate for courts to just declare a principle of accountability in face of growing peril to all youth in this country. By voicing our public trust expectations, Eugene citizens may just create one of those rare moments of judicial synapse with a rising collective public consciousness. We hear that some campaigns, like the one advancing same-sex marriage, have moved with lightning speed. But in fact, lightning doesn't just strike randomly. It represents a connection of atmospheric energy with a charged surface on the ground. The citizens here have charged this ground with demands for climate justice. Second, after months of testimony by Eugene Youth, organized by our Children's Trust, our own Eugene City Council has stepped up and passed what must be the most ambitious climate ordinance in the nation. So we have an opportunity right here to basically create and display to the nation a lifestyle that lives within its budget, a carbon budget. The resource we need most right here and right now is citizen and business initiative, because lifestyle innovation happens in the neighborhoods and only with the help of local merchants. I can think of no better place for such innovation than Eugene, Oregon, but our ambition must match the magnitude of this crisis. As author Alex Steffen observes, when faced with the need to reinvent the material basis of civilization, we can no longer simply ask paper or plastic. The new markers of change are relocalized economies and community resiliency. And a third opportunity for Oregonians is to recognize the stunning leverage we now hold over a global fossil fuel distribution scheme. Those export proposals bombarding our region each require state and local government approvals, and so citizens here hold the power to stop those projects in their tracks, so to speak. These various proposals bring threats of explosion, spills, train accidents, air pollution, and industrial blight with benefits for only a few. Our state is not a fossil fuel state. We have a distinctive regionalism that is tied to the glorious natural beauty surrounding us. So it is not surprising that citizens from all walks of life are rising throughout the Pacific Northwest to protect their communities and to diffuse a carbon bomb over their children's future. To quote Naomi Klein, they're driven by love and they're fierce. And so to conclude, we find ourselves alive at a rather remarkable moment in time. a moment in which scientists warn us that our actions today will determine whether our descendants will literally have a habitable planet they can survive on. It often seems that the science could not be more dismal, nor the politicians' behavior more disillusioning, nor the industry's schemes more disastrous. Yet amidst all of this, Eugene citizens and local leaders dare to dream of making a difference, of harnessing our deep sense of justice, our distinct geographic and legal leverage, and even our unique culture to assert our inalienable public trust rights on behalf of all humanity to come. And that, fellow citizens, is our true Oregon legacy. Thank you very much.
So our first questioner is Joe Mole. He's the executive director of the Mackenzie River Trust.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Mary. Well, my brain got a heck of a workout in that you covered some incredible ground. We've talked about this a bit in the past. Thank you. We've talked about this a little bit in the past. Certainly the work of land trusts is based upon the public trust doctrine. There's no exaggeration there. It's the bedrock of our work. What I'd like you to address is you referred several times to forcing change. There's a flip side of things, and we know as politicized as governments are, there's a real lack of faith that the government can force any kind of change. What about encouragement? What about other approaches to this? You started to touch on those at the end, but I'd love to address that. What sort of encouragement can we give?
Yeah, so law is never the panacea to all our problems. Of course, society is a mix of citizen initiative and government and business. And so what we really need in this crisis that we face is all of those to come into play. And so citizen initiative, just changing lifestyles and creating ideas to present to government to ask them to implement goes a very, very long ways. For example, reforming the bicycle systems of a city, especially our city, things of that nature. But we can't at the same time expect major infrastructure change without government being part of it. Government runs our road system, so there are plenty of citizens who would love to bicycle to save carbon. They can't because it's too dangerous to be on those bike lanes with cars whizzing by. And so it's really a partnership of the citizens coming forth, making demands, and the government responding to those demands. Now, where they don't respond, there may be a reason that they are answering to a higher master than the public. And that can happen with campaign contributions. And so where, for example, a corporation like an oil corporation might donate money to the campaign of a senator or a state legislator, that particular politician may be just serving that company above the public interest, which is why we need courts to come into play to enforce the trust obligation. When those politicians are answering to a higher master than the public, let us be very clear. They are violating one of the most profound fiduciary obligations there is, and that's the duty of loyalty. So they are violating the duty of loyalty to the public. And so the trust has much to offer to all citizens. It doesn't just mean bringing lawsuits in court. Sometimes that is necessary to force the action in time. But it also means addressing legislatures with the proper context of their obligation. And it can inspire citizens. I find that citizens understand the trust and they feel that government should be working for them.
Thank you so much. We'll break now for a few minutes for folks to formulate their questions.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene, 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Welcome back to the January 30th City Club program, The Public Trust Doctrine, Will Courts Protect Resources? City Club members, please identify yourself and keep your questions to about 30 seconds each. We don't have a whole lot of time left, so appreciate your brevity.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. There's a current practice that follows a slogan said in Congress, drill, baby, drill. I think we ought to flip that. Don't burn our babies. Don't. What do you think?
What do I think? I think that says something even more. I think that the public does need responses that are very quick, that really hit the point. And when you talk about babies, you are characterizing the reality.
Jane Smith, City Club member. It's gratifying to know that Oregon is a leader in the climate change effort, but what is the state's argument against the youth and the atmospheric trust?
Well, that's a very good question. The state attorney general is responsible for putting forth the legal position of the state, and she has chosen to spend the state resources on defending a position that goes directly against the youth of the state. And that position is actually the most narrow position of the public trust I've ever seen in any state. It's that the public trust is limited to submerged lands, and that the public trust doesn't have a protective obligation. So they're saying, the Attorney General, I can't believe all of government would feel this way, but the Attorney General representing the youth has the position in the briefs that the public trust doesn't extend to air, and it doesn't impose any duty to protect the atmosphere or the climate system. This is the narrowest version that you could come up with under the public trust. Now, how can that fill up 18 pages of brief? What the argument is that the cases on the books in Oregon dealt with navigable waters. And so her argument is that they cannot be, that they don't announce a public trust in air. Well, that's because no cases have been brought trying to get a court to announce a public trust in air. So now we really come to what is precedent worth in the law. Most lawyers use precedent to figure out the logic behind those decisions, and they apply that logic to new circumstances.
I'm John Attic, City Club member. One of the interesting facts, statistical facts on American elections is that if you outspend your opponent, your chances of winning are 6 out of 7. And given this, and given the tremendous campaign donations from major polluters of water and air, do you favor stricter limits on political campaigns? Give an example would be the Canadian limits of something like $1,240 per individual per candidate, which means that you can donate $1,240 to all the as many candidates as you want, and the Koch brothers, they can donate $1,240 just as much as you can.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great question. And let me say, it doesn't really matter what I favor because I'm just one vote. So let me give you the trust response to that question, which kind of will flip it a little bit. So the reason our system has been corrupted is half because of these campaign contributions, which you talked about, which is clearly part of the problem. Half of it is because the people, the trustees sitting in office, after having received those contributions, are making decisions about our property. So I focus on that part, because both an emphasis on both parts is needed, but no one is focused on the violation of the duty of loyalty that individual legislators have engaged in making decisions after having accepted those contributions. Under standard trust law, that is patently impermissible. That's the basic first step of public trust law. You cannot be biased in your decision making. So I think the court should focus on this other half in addition to the campaign contributions.
Hello, Diane Conrad, City Club member. Thank you for coming. Part of the question I think you've already answered, so let me generalize the question. How can this public trust doctrine principle actually be used as a legal tool, turn it into a legal law?
Okay, well, a legal tool would be getting a court to issue a declaratory judgment. So the Oregon court is positioned to do that, to issue a declaratory judgment setting forth the principles, the very basic principles, the heir is held in trust, and that the state has a trust obligation to protect it. That legal declaration is law. So what I'm trying to help people understand is that law is not just what the legislature makes in statutes, it's also the court's declared principles. And so if that declaratory judgment were to come out, it would be law here, but even more importantly, it would influence the framing of climate all around this country and perhaps even the world, because suddenly people would understand this is our trust property and the governments anywhere have a legal obligation to protect it. Having said that, I think your question is, how do you get the public trust into statutory law? And the city council would be sort of the city ordinance is kind of a microcosm of that. The youth went before the city council, asserted their trust rights. They were organized by Our Children's Trust, and I understand that youth are being organized in Portland as well. So they're using their trust rights to express a duty on behalf of local government, and that could apply to the legislature as well.
Alan Zelenka, City Club member since 1991, and city councilor and author of our climate recovery ordinance. When the youth did do that, they came as a grassroots effort, and the whole trust organization putting lawsuits all over the country is a grassroots organization from the bottom up. The city council acting is kind of from the grassroots level, from the bottom up. But it all seems like a really tough row to hoe, and this whole grassroots effort. And maybe it can help us kind of envision how this actually becomes successful. What's the path? And maybe give examples of where we've seen that happen before. This seems like a tough row to hoe.
Well, it would be the road to hoe if we had more time. You have to go build in the grassroots. I think you have to do that. And if it's any consolation, all over the nation, the grassroots is rising up to demand climate action. But there are these tipping points. And so now we face the very real situation that even if we build a grassroots movement, it may come too late. That is why courts are essential in this. A court injunction and declaration can, with just a piece of paper, change the landscape of obligation to focus the legislatures on their task of lowering carbon dioxide emissions. So that is the power of the third branch. When there's an emergency that violates fundamental human rights, which it will, of life, liberty, and any pursuit, the courts come in before it is too late and just force the other branches to get to work. Again, not coming up with the solutions themselves, but just getting the attention of the other branches.
Rob Zako, City Club member. Mary, thank you very much for being here, and I want to follow up on that question and understand the law better and cut to the chase. So in the case that's being heard on March 13th, imagine that you're the judge and you've decided in your mind in favor of the youth. What are the legal remedies? What order would you give? What would you direct the state of Oregon to do specifically, and what penalties would you impose if they fail to do that?
That's a great question. So the relief is structured in two phases. What is up before the court right now is simply the declaratory judgment. That's a judgment declaring the principles. So that is the first part. Again, I'm saying that would have an impact around the country, I believe. But the meat of it is an injunction, meaning a court forces something for the government, that probably be the agencies, to come up with a plan, a carbon recovery or carbon reduction plan that tracks what the scientists say is necessary. So they would come up with a plan, as courts have ordered many times in other cases, not involving the environment, and they would have to come back to court delivering an accounting of how the carbon is coming down. So it would be called a carbon accounting. They say how it's going under the plan. Now, if they refuse to do that, then the court gets into the situation of what are the backstop remedies. In my scholarship, I said that a court could, for example, order the plaintiffs to not take action on other pending fossil fuel projects. There's these backstop injunctions that you could envision. Ultimately, there's contempt of court. I mean, that's the only remedy the courts have, ultimately, and many heads of agencies have faced contempt of court in other situations not involving the environment for failing to obey a court order.
Kathy Ging, City Club member. How can you be optimistic in face of science, current impacts, and lack of political will to act on climate change? What can we do, and can we attend the court hearing?
Oh, well, that question is easy. The second part, yes, the public can attend the court hearing. I'm not sure if they're, I don't know if they're expecting that many people, but if I were in their shoes, I think I'd start preparing for it. So yes, it's a public hearing on March 13th in local county court. How can I be optimistic? I'm often asked, how do I have any hope? And I tell people, hope is not in my vocabulary for climate, because hope seems like, it seems very passive to me. It seems like you're sort of sitting back, hoping everything will work out okay. I don't even use that word, and you didn't either, but I use the word inspire. When I see children organized by our Children's Trust, and they come before leaders, and they are talking about how scared they are about their future, how they are depressed because no matter what happens, they're going to have a different future than we had. And they come right in front of decision makers. They carry moral authority. And that moral authority in many ways has more of an impact than anything else. It gets leaders to act. And so I really think that citizens just need to use democracy in every way they can, but also get those youth before the leaders, which I know our Children's Trust is doing right now. But it can also be a task for everybody.
Vincenza Scarpacci, City Club member. I think everybody is on your bandwagon, but it seems that this would be almost the impossible dream. But meanwhile, what can we do? And I always think globally, act locally. And one thing that's been bothering me, and I've been in Oregon for 16 years, is that every time I write my representative in the state, how about a annual auto check, emissions check, but they have, I think, in Portland. We don't have it for the state. Every time black smoke comes in my face as I'm driving on the road, I say, okay, we have beautiful air. Let's wait until we don't have beautiful air, and then we'll do something about it. I think that we can be doing things like that. Those little pokes are getting through because those are easy things for people to do. But I'm sorry, it's making a second point, and that's different, and that is, yes, youth is important. They have creativity. But if they don't vote, they're not going to change the system.
Okay, well, let me address the first question. Sometimes I say it's as if we've all fallen out of an airplane, and we've got a big parachute, but for it to open, we all have to pull our cord. And that's really the case with climate. We're falling headlong towards the earth, and we all have a cord. We have to find it, and we have to open it. And your cord might be what you just described. Someone else's cord might be going before city council and saying we need to close some streets to have them just for bikes so people aren't risking their lives being in bike lanes. Other people might go argue for a carbon tax. A carbon tax is clearly, I think, the most effective way of jumpstarting carbon reduction. And so the point is, there are a million things we can do. This is all hands on deck time. In World War II, citizens just rose up, and whatever they had in terms of their talent and their energy and their community, they used it. And so that is the mindset we have to do to right now as we face climate crisis.
Thank you, Professor Wood, for your scholarship and for bringing it here. I want to get into the mechanics a little bit more of what happens after the declaratory judgment comes down from Judge Rasmussen in our favor and your trustees, our trustees, don't do anything. To me, that's quite like what's happened in the busing cases during the time of desegregation. People just refused. The leaders refused, and the judges did end up having to write the plans. And so I'm wondering whether our Children's Trust and others are preparing to help the court impose the plans that are not being developed as ordered.
Well, that's an excellent question. So there's declaratory relief and injunctive relief. The declaratory relief, again, is the signal. These are your duties. The injunctive relief forces the plan. But you're asking what happens if this plan doesn't come about. So number one, the our Children's Trust, and I'm not involved as an attorney in this case, so I don't know what they are thinking. But most attorneys come forth with a set of measures asking the court to implement these measures if the defendants don't follow through. Now, I might just pause here and say that there are plenty of measures. The state of Oregon has plenty of plans. They're on the shelf waiting to be implemented. So it's not as if people have to start from scratch. It's just the political will is not there yet to implement them. Courts can be very aggressive in demanding that fundamental rights be protected. And I don't want to take too long, but I do want to say the Attorney General could use the legal resources of the state and the taxpayers' money to actually come forth with a consent decree. And in a consent decree, which is used in many environmental cases, the plaintiffs and defendants get together, they agree on the principles, and then they get together and work out the solutions. And so really the legal resources of this state could be used right now, instead of filling up briefs, to actually help the agencies come about with the remedies, because those agencies are going to need the state's lawyers to do that. So a consent decree is usually a marvelous solution in complex environmental cases.
Ruth Daimler. I can't help but be really pessimistic at our future now. I see the city council and I see our other elected officials are taking steps backward rather than steps forward. Not all of them, but many of them, the majority are. And so we're getting new roads put in. We don't need new roads put in. We don't need roads enlarged. We don't need farmland. Here, the city council just voted. They just voted to take farmland, graded farmland that we have, and put more of it towards our urban growth boundary to build industry on it. We're going to need every inch. Don't you agree we need every inch of farmland? So much is going to disappear with global warming that we've had already. And I can't understand, how are we going to feed our crops? Our crops have enough crops for people. And we're going off into biofuels that are...
Yeah, let me address that. There's two points you made. First of all, putting money into roads for cars is for a different world. It's simply out of touch with reality. Now, if that money were to go into the roads to create mass transit or light rail or bicycle infrastructure, that would make sense. But for more cars, that's the left hand not paying attention to what the right hand's doing. Now, when you talk about food, we have to understand that we need food. And crops need soil. And the world ahead can only survive. I haven't even talked about adaptation. Climate adaptation, we have a whole lot of change coming right at us sooner than we can plan for it. The best we can do is save all of our resources now, and that means wetlands, it means all agricultural land, because we will not have the ability to buy food and truck it in from other places when climate really starts hitting with impacts. So the smartest thing, the only thing that really looks to the world we live in, is to protect the soils, because they have a premium of value in the world we're entering.
Thank you so much for bringing clarity and vision to this inspiring City Club program, the Public Trust Doctrine Will Courts Protect Resources. And thanks again to our sponsors, John Brown, Eugene Legal, and KRVM. We meet again on February 6th at the Downtown Athletic Club for Facing Lane County's Challenges with guest speaker Steve Mohorisky. Lunches for this program can be ordered on City Club's website or by contacting the office. Thanks all so much for being here.